Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another reality show. I am your host, Golden Hawk, and I am excited to have another wonderful show with wonderful information and a wonderful guest. Today's show is, the chat room today is being brought to you by my lovely chat room host, Tricia Lindner. And she is a travel agent, and anything that we discuss today, whether it's workshops where my guests can be found, or just about anything for any place, if you're looking for a travel agent, Trish Lindner is the girl, my go-to girl, and I will share her with you. Her email address and her website is awttravel@beenthere.com. That's beenthere.com. So feel free to check out her stuff and book trips with her. She's very reasonable and she's very qualified. So let's get on with the show. I am really excited to have my good friend Chuck Gallagher with me today. And we're going to have Chuck on the whole 2 hours, and I want to share with you Chuck's story, because Chuck's story is, I don't want to say it's an unusual one, but it's an extraordinary story, and I was very impressed when I first read about Chuck and saw where he's been, where he came, where he went, and then came again, and then went, and then came again. So let me give you a little background. Chuck Gallagher is a professional speaker. He's a business entrepreneur. He's a sales executive with humble beginnings. He was raised by a single parent in the projects. Most recently, he led a $40-plus million sales region with 125 sales representatives and started his own training business with projects in 30 states. Chuck currently helps employees increase their sales results and skills while realizing the ramifications of their ethical choices. That's a really big, important aspect of who Chuck is, and the emphasis on ethical choices. So I could keep reading, but I'd much rather have Chuck come on in and share his beautiful energy and his story with us all. So let's welcome Chuck to the show. Yay!
Well, thank you very much. It is a pleasure to be with you, Golden Hawk.
Thank you. I enjoy your company, and I enjoy you, and I'm really excited that we have enough time to really kind of go into who you are, Chuck, and where you came from, because I don't tend to focus my shows, quote-unquote, on businesses unless there's some spiritual background behind it. And with you, I think there's a tremendous spiritual background behind you that that it's an honor for me to speak about your businesses and your projects, because I really honor the space that you've come from, and I think it can really help literally millions of other people when they hear your story and we go into that.
Well, that's very kind of you, and I will say that There is very much a spiritual aspect to what takes place in life. Often we become clouded by illusion and believe that what we see is what is real, and perhaps sometimes forget that it really is a spiritual journey in the first place, and that's just something that I have been on, albeit in a somewhat unusual way, as you pointed out.
Right, the unusual way is that you never came to your end. You really kind of got the idea that this is all about a journey, consistently a journey.
Oh, it is consistently a journey. There is no question. Often people won't necessarily recognize that. As I say, sometimes we get so caught up in illusion that we forget what reality may be. But it very much is a journey, just like we are on a journey tonight on this radio show. And I so appreciate your willingness to let me share tonight.
Oh, absolutely, positively. I adore you, Chuck. So you'll be one of my frequent guests, because I always, and Chuck is always creating, always creating. And I so love a person that that goes through life creating and recreating and recreating and recreating, because, you know, this is the way universes are created. This is the way cells are created. This is the way businesses are created. It's he really just follows a format that is pretty much atypical for the physics of life. So I do want to go, let's go into how Chuck Gallagher became a motivational speaker, starting from your exquisite beginnings.
Well, let me start here. I have an opportunity often to speak to groups all around the country. And when I first address a group, I say these words. On first words.
Okay.
Every choice has a consequence. And unlike a lot of motivational speakers that are rah, rah, sis, boom, bye, let's get everybody jumping around, I really stop with the words. Let that sink in. Every choice has a consequence. On October 2nd, 1995, I took 23 steps. I opened the passenger door of an automobile, stepped out, and began walking toward a door. I will tell you on the front end, I really wasn't excited about where I was going. And I counted the steps. And as I took those steps, I thought about my wife. I thought about my two children, Rob and Alex, both of whom were fairly young at the time. I thought about the career that I had aspired to create. I thought about the home that I had lived in and the possessions that I had. I literally thought about everything in my life that defined who I was. And on the 24th step, I opened a door and stepped into federal prison.
That's a big step.
It was a big step. And,
yeah.
You know, it occurred to me as I was walking that the town that I had left, I lived in North Carolina at the time, that the town that I had left, I was Chuck Gallagher. I was a somebody. I had name recognition there and around the country. But when I stepped foot into federal prison, I became 11-642-058.
Wow.
I became an inmate. And I became what most people in the audience would define as a nobody. And it occurred to me, every choice has a consequence. Now, I say that, and Goldie, what typically will happen when I'm speaking to a live audience is they're just sitting there just kind of looking at me. It's really kind of funny, I have to admit, because you get these two kinds of looks. One is that jaw-dropped look like, what are you talking about? This guy kind of dressed up, you know, in a suit and looks like any normal person is an inmate. You get that look. And
right.
Then you get the look from the people on the front row that are like, oh, my gosh. What did he do? And I say, no, I shouldn't have sat on the front row. We should have sat on the back row. And you can see them punching their husbands and things like that. It really is quite comical.
Indeed.
So it's a little funny to watch the expression, but the thing that is absolutely a fact is when people see what would appear to be just like any other normal person walking around that you would see in your journey today, stand before you and say, I'm 11-642-058. I have been an inmate in federal prison. All of a sudden, people start to pay attention to what you have to say because they're wondering, well, how did you get there? What did you do, and how did that take place? That's one question.
Right.
And the other question is, okay, well, you're out, but you don't look like a convict. And how have you been able to achieve success, and yet you're a convicted felon? It's like that's not
Right.
Right, right. And see, that's why your story is so exquisite, because I think people, for whatever their reasons, whether it's their lack of education or whatever gender they might be for something that they're going for, in other words, there's many reasons why we believe we could not achieve success because fill in the blank.
What?
And clearly one of those statements would be, as a convicted inmate or a convicted felon, I could not achieve success, because every time on that application, I've got to check, you know, have you been to prison? Yes. Or
right.
Have you been convicted?
Have you been convicted of a felony? Absolutely.
Right. So I want you to share how you went from there to a motivational speaker, a successful businessman, and running $40 million companies. Sorry, that's that Goldie language again.
Yeah, that's fine. Goldie language is good. I like that Goldie language.
Indeed. So continue, please.
Well, let's do this, because you know the people that are going to be listening to this show. I have learned over the years, as I have spoken to groups all around, that you got to answer the questions, because if you don't, they sit around puzzled. So let's first talk about what the heck did I do to get there?
There you go. Okay.
And kind of take a little bit of the background. Now, and I'm going to go back, and I won't bore you with all of the intimate details, but the time that I walked into federal prison was on October 2nd, 1995. So I'm going to first go backwards a little bit to 1990.
Okay.
And in 1990, I was tax partner in a CPA firm. I had testified before Congress, before the United States House Ways and Means Committee. I'd written articles in national magazines, and I sure enough taught in 30 different states. And at that point, it was, I want to say it was November of 90, I was teaching a course in Boise, Idaho, to a group of CPAs. And as you can imagine, if you have to sit for 8 hours listening to somebody talk about tax law, that can be pretty boring. But as you know me, I am not the kind of person that wants anything to be boring.
Right.
So we had like tax sing-along songs and all kind of fun things.
There you go.
Like tax returns, money on the way. We fill out the messy forms that the clients have to pay. I mean, you know, good stuff like that.
You're crazy. I love it.
So, well, I mean, you might as well have some fun with this stuff while you're doing it. So I'm sitting there and I'm doing this course, and at lunch we broke, and there was a little pink slip on the door. And it said, you know, the while you were out message kind of thing. Now, that was the days before everybody walked around with a cell phone slapped to them so that you got messages in the old-fashioned way. And it said, call the office. So I debated. I was hungry. I was on East Coast time, but in mountain time. Do I eat or do I call the office? And I finally said, okay, you know, I'll just call the office, get it over with. And when I did, my partner got on the other end, and he said, hey, Chuck, he said, one of the clients that you had invested money for, well, they've had a change of circumstance, and they need to liquidate the investment like now. They need the money ASAP. And I know you're out in Idaho. Just tell me where the file is and who I need to contact, and let me go ahead and get this process underway, because they're adamant that they need the money.
Okay.
Now, Goldie, when I got that call, and I'm going to say this because I think I know your audience. But when I talk to groups in general, I say God, however we define God, but God and I knew the truth. And that was, I had not invested that client's money. I had stolen it.
Okay.
And at that moment, when I heard my partner's voice over the telephone, it was clear to me that my life had just changed.
Yeah.
I did not have access to funds to continue the charade, to continue the illusion. It's a lot like Bernie Madoff, who made the news this past year in 08 and certainly into 09. There's a point at which you can't continue the scheme.
Right.
And I was there. And while no one else in the room knew what had taken place, and certainly my partner didn't, I knew that call was a life-changing event.
Right.
And I did the only thing I knew how to do at the time, and that was get him off the telephone. So I told him, I said, look, I said, you know, number one, it's not like there's just money sitting at Merrill Lynch or what have you. So I said, and I said, I know who the money was invested with. I've got their number. I'll go ahead and give them a call right now. Tell the client it's not easily liquidatable. It's going to take a little bit of time, but give them a call. And you probably don't remember, but I'm going to be back tomorrow. I was on there on a Wednesday, and I think I was flying back Thursday morning.
Okay.
So I said, you know, I'll meet with you, and we'll go over the details, but I'll go ahead and get it taken care of. He said, are you sure? I said, yeah, no problem. Don't worry about it. He said, are you sure? Not a problem. And by the way, I got to go. I got to get back to class to get him off the telephone.
Okay.
Now, that afternoon, I'm going to admit, I don't have a clue what I did. I mean, I went back into the class, and I taught the class that I was supposed to teach, and I had taught it time after time after time. So I just, it was kind of like being on autopilot.
Right.
It just happened. But when that afternoon's class finished and the people got up and a few come and shake your hands and the rest of them leave and they get their paperwork together, and before the folks at the hotel come in to start cleaning up, I sat down on the stage and I have to admit I cried like a baby because I knew that the choices that I had made many years earlier, which I somehow had this feeling that there was just somehow I was going to avoid the consequences, that all of a sudden now I would be facing those consequences.
Right.
Now, that night I went to the hotel room, and this is kind of heavy, but I went to the hotel room and I thought about suicide.
Right.
Because, you know, all of a sudden, if you, and I know this is, it's an odd thing to say, but I say it to all the groups that I speak to, because every one of us as human beings, spiritual beings living in a human existence, we all face what many have referred to as a dark night of the soul.
Yes, indeed.
And that comes different for different people. You know, some people who are listening to this will very judgmentally say, well, I've never stolen money. I'd never steal money from anybody. I mean, I can't imagine. Okay, fine. So yours isn't that.
Right.
Your dark night comes from something else.
It could be physical. It could be the breakup of a relationship, somebody dying. It's whenever your life dramatically takes a change in a new direction.
Absolutely. And that was my dark night of the soul. The problem with suicide for me was I'm a chicken. I mean, I hate pain. You know, so I'm sitting there, it's like, okay, well, I'm in Boise, Idaho. It's not like I got a car and can park it in the garage. That's out.
Right.
You know, you don't fly around with a gun. I wouldn't know how to use one if I had it. So
right.
That wasn't working. I had one of those little blue Bic shavers, you know, those little portable that you could whack all day long. I mean, it doesn't even do good at taking whiskers off. So, you know, I'd have been hacked to death. And the only other thing I could think of was jumping off the roof. And I've often wondered, and not that I want to find the answer to this question out, but from jump time to splat time, what do you think about? Because there's got, you know, there's that few seconds there. And I was like, dude, I don't know if I can handle that kind of pain. So I began looking. I pulled out a Yellow Pages. Of course, today you'd Google it.
Right.
But, you know, I pulled out of Yellow Pages, and I began looking for psychiatrists, psychologists, proctologists. I didn't care. As long as it was medically related, somebody needed to talk to old Chuck.
Right.
So here I am. I get these people on the telephone. I'm sorry you reached the office of Dr. Such and Such. Our office hours are from 8:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. You have reached us after hours, but if you'll leave your name and number, we'll be happy to give you a call. Have a nice day. Now, you know, if you're thinking about killing yourself and you get seven of those in a row, it starts to tick you off. So now I went from despair to getting angry. And on the eighth one, somebody answered the telephone. It was a guy. You know, Dr. Such and Such's office. Couldn't tell you what the name was.
Right.
And I said, you know, my name's Chuck Gallagher. I need to talk to somebody. He said, I'm the last person here. I'm getting ready to have dinner with my wife. Our office is closed, but if you'll give me your name and number, I'll be happy to have somebody call you in the morning. At which point, I'm like, you're kidding. I'm saying, okay, I'm thinking about suicide. And the guy said, let's talk. Now, Goldie, I don't know if we talked for 2 minutes 20 minutes, 2 hours. Not a clue. Don't know the man's name. I don't know if he was the janitor. I don't know who the last guy in the building was.
Right.
But he said something to me that is, have you ever seen kind of like a granite tombstone or marble?
Sure.
And you see somebody's name etched in it? Well, what this guy said to me just like etched in my brain. I mean, I can hear it when I repeat it. He said, son, you've made a bad mistake, but you are not a mistake.
Wow.
Son, you've made a bad mistake, but you are not a mistake. He then went on to say, the choices you make now will define the rest of your life and the legacy you leave to your two sons. Make those choices wisely.
Now, let's see.
Now, I don't remember, as I said, couldn't tell you how long we talked, couldn't tell you who it was that I talked to, but I can hear his voice as if it were today, and that was in 1990, so we're talking 19 years ago. I'm getting gray-headed. I should start to forget some of that stuff, but it's still there.
Well, that's a defining moment, clearly.
It was clearly a defining moment. And some people will ask the question, well, you know, when were your defining moments? Well, that was one of them, because that was the thing that really solidified for me the relationship between choices and the consequences that follow. We get confused sometimes as spiritual beings living a human existence into thinking that if we make a choice and there is no immediate consequence, then there is no consequence. And that is an illusion.
Right.
There is always a consequence. Now, I went, I did not end my life. Yay. And so the next day I hopped on a plane, and I flew back to the airport, Charlotte, North Carolina, and drove to my home in Western North Carolina. And as I was traveling, that, by the way, did not make the day better. It just was a defining moment that clarified things. So I'm driving back home, and I'm thinking, do I talk with my partners or talk with my wife? Partner's wife, partner's wife, partner's wife. I think I'll do the partners first.
Okay.
Because, you know, the idea of going home and having to admit that you're a liar and a thief to your wife is just not an exciting thing to do.
Right.
So I met with my partners the next day, and I asked them to go in the conference room that I needed to talk with them, and they did, and I told them what had happened, and I can still recall the looks on their faces. One of the things that is a truth about life is that success in many ways, it's not the only thing, but success in many ways is built on trust. And if you destroy trust, as I did with my partners and with my wife, when you destroy trust, you have taken out the foundation for what could be successful. It doesn't mean you can't have success, but trust is the foundation on which success will be built.
Okay.
So I went in and I talked to my partners. Well, obviously, I destroyed their trust. One of the partners looked at me. I can see it today. He had steel blue, kind of blue-gray eyes, and he looked at me and he said, well, he said, I have a solution. Now, Goldie, I'd flown a 4-plus-hour flight back thinking, you know, maybe my partners will take me to the woodshed. Give me a good whooping. I mean, there's a lot of things I can think of to say, but probably shouldn't say on radio.
Thank you.
You know, I'm going to be nice.
Indeed.
But, they could have done whatever they wanted to, but I was hoping that maybe they would have the wisdom, this is Chuck speaking, wisdom to say, why don't we just go borrow the money, pay these people off, make me an indentured servant for the rest of my life, whatever it happened to be, but, let's just sweep it under the rug and make it go away.
Okay.
So when he looked and he said, I got a solution. I was thinking, oh, hallelujah, thank goodness. Somebody with a smarter mind than I is going to be able to come up with something that's going to work on this thing. His response, I think you should kill yourself.
Oh, my God. Wow.
He said, your life insurance, the two-year contestability clause for suicide, he said, that's passed. He said, you've got sufficient money to pay off these people who deserve to get their money back because they didn't deserve for you to lie to them and cheat them out of their funds. He said, we didn't deserve this as your partners. We brought you in here, made you a partner in this firm, and this is the way you thank us. And your wife and children, they don't deserve it. In fact, if you kill yourself, they will have, after what you have to pay these people, the debt from the stolen money, He said there'll be plenty left for them, for their college and to live comfortably from here on out. And the people in the community will take pity on your wife and kids, and you don't deserve to be a good memory.
Wow. Well, that's pretty harsh, Chuck.
it was less than pleasant.
Yeah.
The other partner looked at me and he said, well, you're fired, which I kind of expected that.
Right.
And then he looked at me and he said, but, probably you'll recover one of these days. I suspect probably it'll end up you'll be in sales and marketing. Now, the funny part to me is, now at 2009, is one of the partners read my mind from the night before. And so I guess he was psychic by some stretch of the imagination. And the other partner predicted the future because I have been a senior VP of sales and marketing in a public company.
Right.
So between the two, both of them having a little psychic tap in, I kind of like the second one better. The guy predicting the future was a whole lot more friendly than the one that wanted me to off myself just so people could be paid.
Yeah, exactly.
But, before people who listen to this pass judgment, let's think about the reality of when we make choices and when we destroy people's trust and when there is anger, you're going to get responses like that. And it's so easy to look back and say, well, how dare he say that to you? My goodness, doesn't he have a value for life? Yada, 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 yada. And the answer was, yeah, he did. But people have to have the ability to express whatever it is they need to express. I don't hold that against him. He expressed his feeling, and we moved on. I didn't choose to take his advice, and I don't think he really intended me to do that.
Well, I agree. It was a knee-jerk reaction to something he didn't expect to hear.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, most of the time at this stage, people are going to be like, okay, well, you took money from people, all right? So how did that happen? I mean, what would cause an otherwise reasonably intelligent, competent individual who, became a CPA, became partner in a firm, wrote articles, testified before Congress, and all of that stuff, why would you take money? So I'm going to rewind the tape back a little further.
Okay? I like that you're covering this. This is good. Okay.
So when I had wonderful parents. My dad died when I was 2 years old from complications from, early childhood diabetes.
Okay.
So my mother was, by that, became a single parent.
Right.
Okay. Now, she was like a lot of ladies of her age, and that is she did not, in the South, she did not have a high school education.
Right.
So, if you're a female in the Southeast United States without a high school education, what do you do? How do you make money? Well, you could work for a textile mill.
and those were in the days before they went to China, of course. Or you could work as a lunchroom lady, because most anybody could take a can opener and open a can of peas, and y'all remember lunchroom food, I'm sure, from years ago. Or you could be a janitor, because most anybody can sling them up.
Right.
And she really did all three. And what would be defined today, now I'm going to say this kind of, not to be funny, but what would be defined today as living in poverty is how we lived. But kids, especially that we, you know, when you're young, you don't understand poverty. Poverty is a taught concept. You know, if you're 3 years old in 2009 and the house is about to be foreclosed, mom and dad are worrying about the foreclosure. The kid at 3 years old is worrying about what he or she is going to play with in the next 30 minutes.
Right.
So, you know, as a kid, I just didn't really comprehend that, you know, we really didn't have a lot. What we had is what we had.
Right.
But mom always said to me, she said, son, she said, doesn't make any difference what you have or how much you have. She said, get a good education. And when you grow up, you can be somebody. She would tell me that over and over again. You can be somebody. Don't let your economic circumstances stand in the way. And in fact, when I was in high school, sure enough, we grew up in what would be defined as the projects.
Okay.
And, you know, most people in the projects, I say this today, maybe it's different, I don't know. But at least at the time I was coming up, most people in the projects seemed to feel like, oh, man, we're poor. We live in the projects. We'll never get out of here. This is just what our life is meant to be. It's like walking into a brick wall thinking there is no way out.
Right, right. They look for the apartment down in the other house of the project.
Right. And it's like, I just never thought of that. I mean, you know, when people in the projects were throwing their litter out the window because it's like we live in the projects, so it should be a garbage dump, I took a broom handle, sawed it off, put a nail in the end of it, and went to the people at the projects and said, don't you want somebody to pick up the trash?
Right.
And, you know, so my first job was being a garbage man.
Okay.
And I picked up the trash that other people threw down. I figure, heck, that's recession-proof. They're too dumb. They keep throwing stuff out. That keeps me with the job, and people are paying me to pick up the crap. No problem. I'm okay with that. So when I got out of high school, I went to college and I put myself through school. And you know, I got my accounting degree. I got a master's degree in accounting and of course, ultimately became a CPA. But Goldie, the thing that I didn't know it at the time, didn't kind of click in my brain. But one of the things that we were taught, you know, you go through college and they're giving you all of the analytical stuff that you need to know because, you know, you really need to be well-rounded and astute in business, was leverage. Okay?
Well,
Leverage was, here's the best example. Buy the most expensive house that you can barely afford. Okay? Now, what's the concept behind that? And I don't know, you pick the number, the number doesn't make any difference. But if I could, you know, if I went in and I applied for a loan and they said, well, Chuck, you can qualify to buy a $200,000 house. That's the maximum. Then the teaching was, well, then buy a $200,000 house. Now, the payment's going to be hard to make. It's going to be tough those first couple of years. But if you could make it past those first couple of years, a couple of things should happen. Now, this is what you're taught.
Okay.
One, your income should go up because, you know, you've got a job, so every year they're supposed to give you a raise. Okay? So, therefore, it becomes a little easier to make those payments. Two, the price of the house should increase. Now, obviously, they didn't take a look in the mirror or, you know, the crystal ball and see 2009 and see houses going down.
Right, right.
But, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, yes, the house typically steadily increased a little bit every year. And third, the longer you make those payments, the more you've paid toward the principal on the house, which means you're paying down debt. So my $200,000 house is now worth $250,000. I've paid down $25,000 on the mortgage, so I only owe $175,000. My income went up.
And the idea was, oh, you've got $75,000 worth of equity. Why don't you go borrow against your house, cash out, get that $75,000 and buy more stuff?
Yeah.
Okay?
Okay.
Now,
the American way, actually, the more I think about it.
Yeah, it really is. It's in fact, I'm kind of deviating here, but it's really kind of scary because, you know, you hear about, oh, my gosh, what the economy's doing, and we need people to go out and borrow to buy more stuff.
I know.
And it's like, what? Am I missing something here? Let's see. You ultimately have to pay back the debt.
Right.
So if you borrow to buy more stuff, are we as a country, this is maybe a rhetorical question, maybe it's good for people to call in and answer, but are we as a company defined by what we have? Because I sure thought that's what I was defined by. So here it is, it's the 80s on my timeline. I've graduated, I've gotten the CPA, I'm doing my thing, and I bought the most expensive house that I could barely afford. And we missed two house payments right after my son was born, first son. And the banker calls me. Now, think about this. I am the upstanding CPA in the community, you know, the new up-and-comer.
Right.
And the bank calls and says, Mr. Gallagher, according to our records, you've missed two house payments. Is there a problem? Now, bankers don't tend to send you clients if they don't think you can manage your own money.
Yeah.
And here I was, and I couldn't make my house payment.
Right.
So I did the only thing I knew how to do. I was pretty good at this, by the way, and that was dance. I don't mean like Dancing with the Stars dance. I mean I could just shuck and jive on the telephone. Okay?
Okay.
So I said, are you sure you haven't misapplied my payments? And he was like, I don't think so. And I said, I believe you should check your records. Well, you know, I could throw out those words and cause him to wonder. And he said, well, let me check. I'll call you back. Okay?
Okay.
So he gets off the telephone, and I'm sitting there. Now, here's what's going through my head. By the way, for the listeners, I was born in June. I am a Gemini. Okay?
Okay.
So I am naturally two people. I'm like, you know... I know Geminis understand this. The rest of the world's like, you people are crazy. In fact, I will tell you, one of the best things that's ever happened is Bluetooth. Because in the old days, if you drove down the road and you were talking to yourself, people thought you were crazy.
That's truth. That's true.
You know, you'd look at somebody and when you're at the stoplight and they're sitting there just carrying on a conversation, you're like, man, those people need to be at a mental institution. Now it's perfectly normal because your phone connects to the Bluetooth in the car and you can sit there and carry on a conversation and people think, oh, they're just talking on the phone.
Right.
So I'm so thankful for that. But anyway, back to the story.
I am too, and I don't have Bluetooth. I just have conversations with myself.
Don't you think that is natural? I think it is perfectly natural to have a conversation.
I not only think it's natural, I think it's healthy. I think it's healthy to hear myself. Answers come differently for me when I speak it out loud than when I think it inside my head. Especially,
yeah, girl, I am so with you on that.
Yeah, especially when I'm calling in non-physical help. That tends to be much more powerful if I call in the masters or the angels or whatever entity I'm choosing to work with verbally out loud. So I deviated.
Yep.
Keep going, babe.
No. That is quite all right. I agree with you 100%, and I have had some of the best butt chewings with people when I was in the car by myself because I can chew somebody's butt so good and get it out of my system so then when I sit down, we can have an intelligent and calm conversation.
It
really is a wonderful thing. Anyway, got this guy off the telephone, and here's what happened. I was – trustee of a trust. I was the one responsible for a client's money, and I had a conversation with myself, and it went something like this. I looked at my trustee self, and I said, you know, whew, man, I need some money to make some house payments, and I ain't got none right now. My trustee self, a bit more intelligent, looked back at me and said, I'm trustee of this trust. I could loan you the money, but of course you'd have to pay interest. So I look back at my trustee self. Now, keep in mind, now this is a conversation between me.
I get that.
Me, myself, okay. And I look back and I said, you know, dude, that would be so much help. I look back and I said, you do know you have to pay it back. And I said, yeah, of course, I got that. He said, you do know you have to sign a note. Yeah, I got that. He said, okay, let's take care of this. So I sat down at a computer, and I typed out a note. Now, let me just – I'm going to park that for just a second, because when I'm talking to folks, it's important for people to understand how easy and simple it is to make a choice that can have a profound consequence.
Okay.
And there's three components to it.
Okay.
It's like a three-legged stool. And if any one of the legs don't exist, the you can't sit on the stool.
Okay? Right.
One of them is need. So I had a need for money. That was one of the legs of the stool.
Okay.
The second leg of the stool is opportunity. In my case, I was trustee of a trust. Someone entrusted me with taking care of their money. So I had the opportunity.
Okay.
The money was accessible to me.
Right.
The third one, and this one is probably the psychological key, is rationalization.
Okay.
Okay?
I'm sorry. I'm not laughing at you. I'm just, it's so funny. I'm listening. I'm thinking in my own head how many times I've rationalized.
Okay, and yeah. It's rationalization. I rationalize. Now, everybody listening to this show, whether it's now or whether they listen sometime, some later point in time, here's a reality check. The reality check is when you know what you're doing is wrong, but you can rationalize doing it to make it right, you have crossed a boundary. Now, everybody listening to this would say, you're kidding. You mean to tell me that you took money from a trust when somebody didn't know you were taking money from a trust? That's theft. That's wrong. Everybody would say that.
Right.
I would say that.
Right, right.
But I rationalized it as a loan.
Right.
I created a document. That's part of the rationalization. I convinced myself that if I typed out a note, signed the note, put it in the file, stole the freaking money,
right,
that somehow I had really borrowed it and it was really okay.
Right.
And I'm going to change the subject again. I'm parking this for a second. I promise I'll come right back to it. But it's no different than if you have an extramarital affair.
Okay.
I'm not making judgments. There's no judgment to this. I'm just pointing out the kinds of things. You could sit down as a man. You could sit down and say, you know, my wife and I, we just don't have the love that we used to have. Sex isn't as good. Wah, 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 wah. And come along, and you feel like you have a need to be validated. There's your need. You know, the newest young secretary at the office has shown an interest in you and given you an opportunity, and you rationalize it based upon, well, obviously my wife isn't interested, or we would have a more romantic relationship or what have you, and in reality, she'll never know, and once you've rationalized it and crossed the line, you can't take it back.
Right.
There is a consequence for every choice that is made, and in my case, that was the beginning of taking money. Now, the banker calls me back. He says, we've checked our records, and before he could get it out of his mouth, I turned on what I'm going to call the Chuck Charm, and I said, I am so sorry. I am so sorry. You're absolutely right. That payment was not made. I checked my records, and then I did the Adam and Eve kind of thing. You know, for anybody that wants to get into the story, I blame the woman. I said, my wife pays the bills.
Got your picture.
Well, you know, I mean, I just have to be honest. The women listening to it are like, I knew it. Men are just like that. I can't believe that he did. Well, that's what I did. I'm just going to be honest. May as well just, you know, point out my fallacies. I blame my wife, and I said, I am so sorry. I'm going to bring you a check up right now. I am so embarrassed. And then the banker, this is really funny, he says to me, don't worry about it. He said, let me tell you a little secret. He said, I passed a bad check in college once.
Wow.
It was like we had this male bonding experience, you know. I admitted that my wife screwed up our finances, and he admitted he passed a bad check, and man, it was really great. He sent me more business than you could shake a stick at, because now we were tight, you know.
Right, right.
Okay. Well, make a long story short, I paid back that money, which in my head, Goldie, meant I really solidified the rationalization. And
so
I found out.
Okay, wait. Let me. So you, in other words, you, because you paid it back, it never felt like the wrong move to you. Is that what
as
you mean?
As soon as I, right, absolutely. As soon as I paid it back, it felt like it really was a legitimate loan.
Okay.
You know, I typed up the note. I had the need. I had the opportunity, and I really rationalized it with the note. And then when I paid it back, it was like, yes, that was truly a loan.
Okay.
So I stole more. And I bought a bigger house. I bought new cars. I bought bunches of stuff, things that were outward symbols of success. And I found out something.
Okay.
I found out it worked. I found out that people looked at me and they said, gosh, he really must be smart. He must look at his success. He's got a new BMW. He's got a new Mercedes. He's got a new Jaguar. He's living in a new house. This guy really must be smart. Man, he really is successful.
Right.
And in November of 1990, one of the people that I had stolen money from said, excuse me, but I need the money right now. And that's when it's like building a house of cards.
Yeah.
When you pull one card out, the whole thing collapses.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what took place.
Okay, that's I really honor and respect your honesty and your level of you should see the chat room. The chat room's kind of funny because they're all talking about their infidelities and going, oh, you might be Gemini, but infidelity is for the Sagittarians. My beautiful friend Steve is saying.
Oh, that's classic.
Well, because, and one of the reasons why I really honor and love you so much is because I think we all have rationalized at some point in our lives. And the key is what that doctor said to you that night, that we make mistakes, but we are not our mistakes. You know, in
right.
other words, it's an action of who we are to get us to understand ourselves that living ethically would mean a peace of mind that, you know, once you understood, you don't have to chase that whole successful trail of stuff, that you
yep.
can live in everything you can afford and feel tremendously better than the appearance of the success chasing and stealing to keep it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, the thing that really was profound beyond what he said was coming home and after talking with my partners, talking with my wife, and it was I'm not even sure I know the exact words to use to describe it. It was a humbling experience. That's one word. There's a multitude that are flowing through my head really quickly right now. But to have to admit who you are, it's like peeling back the layers of an onion.
Okay.
And ultimately, when all the layers were peeled back, what I had to tell my wife is that I was a liar and a thief.
Okay.
That the life that I had created was an illusion. It was like one big David Copperfield show.
Well, and let me interrupt for a moment. And during the illusion, did you ever feel peaceful?
No, I felt needful.
Yeah.
There was never a satisfaction. It's like the Rolling Stones song, I Can't Get No Satisfaction.
Yeah.
That's what it felt like. There was no satisfaction. It didn't make any difference. I could buy the best car. It wasn't good enough. I needed another one.
Yeah.
I could have the best house. It wasn't good enough. I needed another one. It was like there was this fix.
An addiction, right? Like a fixation addiction.
Right.
Yeah.
It was the need for more stuff. And all of that was utilized to rationalize and validate ego.
There you go.
It's all, you know,
That dirty three-letter word.
I mean, you know, who are you? Well, my ego needed to be fed, and I was frantically feeding it. And then when you admit you're a liar and a thief, I'm fired. I owe people money to the tune of $250,000.
Wow.
I'm going to be shamed in the community. I will lose my license. I will lose my livelihood. The world as I know it is dramatically going to change. Then all of a sudden you start to come to grips with, well, what does it mean to be a Chuck Gallagher?
Right.
Now, I was lucky. I'm going to say that. Lucky maybe isn't, maybe it's not the right word. It sounds like a very human word to me.
Okay.
Fortunate. Blessed that there were people in my life who saw value in me when I didn't see it in myself.
Right.
So family and friends rallied around and helped me legitimately make restitution.
Okay.
Now, the people that I stole money from, let's just talk about those folks for a second. They were really ticked off. They were less than happy. They had entrusted me. I had violated their trust. I had taken their money without their knowledge. That's theft. And they had different sorts of emotional feelings. Some of them probably hated me. Who knows exactly the exact feeling. But the one thing they wanted, there was one thing they wanted more than they wanted me in jail.
Well, they wanted to get paid,
and that was,
right?
They wanted their money back.
Right.
Yep.
Well, because
so,
you realize, too, that what must have went through their head is, how could I let this happen to me?
Right.
Right?
It is. That's true. How could it happen to me? And there's a really weird thing that takes place. And it was this year that it really started to come out. Okay.
Okay.
And it goes back to Bernie Madoff because it's an easy example.
Okay.
But Bernie comes along, and a lot of people trust Bernie, and Bernie is the guy, and, man, he's Mr. Wall Street, and, I mean, Bernie is the man. And then all of a sudden people find out Bernie is full of crap,
right,
and it's not true, and it was all a sham, and they're sitting back, and there's almost these two emotions taking place. I am a victim. How could this happen to me? This isn't right. And they get on this victim freaking soapbox.
Right.
And I don't mean this in a rude way. Your chat room probably go crazy on this because victims hate being called out.
I don't have victims in my chat room.
but there ain't no such thing as a victim. Whatever happens in our life, we are actively involved in creating it.
Absolutely, rock on. And to be honest, I have very I know everybody in the chat room. I know so, and they're all conscious. So keep going.
So, you know, there is the one side, which is, how could I have let it happen? That is a very healthy question. Or the victim is, how could this happen to me? This isn't right.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay? Fortunately, because they wanted their money more than they wanted me in jail, and I was fortunate, blessed enough to have people who saw that Chuck Gallagher was really worth something when I obviously didn't have that in my head, I was able to make restitution. Let's put it this way. Restitution was made because people helped me make it.
Okay.
That's the best way I can say it.
Okay?
It wasn't anything that I had personally the power to make happen.
Right.
And the local district attorney didn't want to prosecute me. He figured I'd lost my house, I'd lost my income, I'd lost my assets, I'd lost my license as a CPA. I'd probably suffered enough. The people had been repaid
with
interest. And I used to do the guy's tax return and did a pretty good job, and he probably figures I'd give him a break.
Okay. So wait a minute. So you didn't go for jail for $250,000, so...
Okay, so hang with me.
So the story doesn't end. You didn't become the motivational speaker at this point. Wow. Okay, keep going.
All right, it's 1991. It's the middle of the year, and there's this knock on the door. You know, if you had, like, sound effects, it would be clock, knock, knock, knock.
Okay.
And I go to the door. I look through the little peephole, and there's two guys standing out there. They're both in, like, suits and ties and stuff. And I'm thinking, okay, they're either door-to-door salespeople or they're handing out religious tracts.
Okay.
It's one or the other. And I debated to myself, which was it? I'll open the door and just find out. I opened the door, and they said, are you Charles Gallagher? Now,
But Goldie, let me ask you a quick question. Where did you grow up as a kid?
Connecticut.
Connecticut, okay. Now, see, I can't speak to Connecticut. I can speak to the Southeast United States, okay? And the way it works in the Southeast United States is if everybody knows me as Chuck, and then someday somebody says, "Are you Charles?" you know there's a problem, okay?
Okay.
If your name is William Robert and everybody calls you Billy Bob and your mama says, "William Robert, you get over here right now," you know there's a problem.
Okay.
And in fact, that's how we were disciplined. You know, they'd call out your real given name and then they would get what we call the switch and
right.
They would switch your legs. That's how I learned to dance.
Okay.
Because, you know, I mean, anyway.
Keep going. I want to know how you didn't learn from the first one there, Chuck. Charles.
So these guys, Charles Gallagher, and I said, yes. They reach in their pockets and pull out the most beautiful gold badges I've ever seen in my life.
Okay.
One was from the Department of Labor. He wanted to prosecute me for embezzlement from retirement plans. I had violated the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. The ironic thing, this is kind of one of those karmic ironic type things that might all come about in one lifetime, is that I taught CPAs the rules of the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974 whilst breaking them so that the federal government wanted to prosecute me for breaking that law.
I see.
Okay. The other one was from the IRS.
Ah, Steve was right. Steve typed it in the chat room, IRS. Okay.
Yep, IRS wanted to prosecute me for not paying tax on stolen money.
Sorry. God.
That never.
God bless the IRS.
I mean, you know, I'm tax partner in a CPA firm, for God's sake. It never crossed my mind on line 37 of the 1040 to put other income, stolen money, and pay tax on it. I mean, what moron would pay tax on money that they stole that they didn't want people to know they stole?
Right, right.
So the wheels of government do move somewhat slowly. And they wanted to prosecute, and ultimately in 1995, now 4 years later, I had pled guilty, and on October 2nd, I took 23 steps into federal prison.
Okay, so it was the same crime. It was just later on that it was...
Same crime, different group of prosecutors wanted to go after old Chuck.
Okay.
Now, I get into federal prison. Let's go down that road for a minute.
Okay.
I walk in. They put me in an 8x10 cinder block room with a wooden bench and a toilet. Give me a 15-page photocopied booklet of the rules in federal prison.
Okay.
Which they obviously, the federal government obviously had cut back on the printing costs because these things were photocopied crooked and they were terrible, but whatever.
Right.
And in 10 minutes, I had read the rules. And I sat for 45 minutes. Excuse me, 2 hours and 45 minutes before I was processed.
Okay.
Door opens to the holding cell. They said, "Step forward." I step out, and there's a guy in a white lab coat. His name was Pedro, had it embroidered on his lab coat jacket. And next cell steps out. It was a large African-American guy. I mean, this guy looked like he could have been a linebacker for the Dallas Cowboys. He was a big guy.
Okay.
Huge.
Yeah.
Third holding cell, a Hispanic guy comes out who was tattooed all over his natural body, as best I could tell. And I really didn't want to see without clothes.
Right.
Pedro pulls out a needle. He says, "Okay, it's time for your TB test."
Oh, my.
Now, Goldie, you know, I don't know how people in your world are, but I think this is a fairly true statement. Men do not have the same tolerance for pain that women do.
Okay.
And I hate needles.
I have someone in the chat room I know resonates with this. Keep going.
Oh, I hate needles. And he pulls out this TB test needle that's got 4 needles on the end of it. And I'm thinking, oh, crap. Then he says, "Roll up your sleeve. You're going to be first." I roll up my sleeve, and I'm thinking to myself, all right, Chuck, you've got to be strong. You've got to be strong here now, dude. And about 2 weeks before, I had seen the movie The Shawshank Redemption.
Wait a minute, Chuck, someone in the chat room, I just want to answer. Did your wife stay with you or leave?
Yeah, well, she stayed for the time being.
So this part of the story, she's still with you?
Technically. She, let me address that.
Because they're asking that, so go ahead.
That's absolutely fine. My marriage disintegrated when I had to admit that I was a liar and a thief.
Okay.
The marriage never healed from that. My wife could never get past the fact that she could not trust me.
Okay.
She did want to. It was an oddity. I say it's an oddity. I don't think it's odd. Odd. She wanted to stay together for the sake of the children, but the marriage died.
Okay.
Because she could never regain trust. And I don't fault her for that, by the way, just to make sure we're all clear. That wasn't her fault. I was the one that broke the trust.
Okay.
But it didn't make any difference what I did. She could never completely regain that trust.
Right.
So we were legally separated when I went to prison, and there was a good likelihood there would be a divorce, but the reality was, at the time I went to prison, we were legally separated.
Okay. Okay.
Okay?
Yep.
Okay. So Pedro's there. He sticks me in the, you know, in the arm with this TB test, which, you know, most anybody could stomach easily. I unfortunately begin to pass out. and I said, man, I got to sit down. He says, what's wrong, man? You allergic to needles? And I'm like, you know, I just need to sit down. And then he screams, we've got a fainter. And I'm like, you know, dude, it's my first day in prison. I've been here for 3 hours, and you're hollering out to the inmate population that I'm a fainter? I mean, I'm going to be somebody's wife before the night's over, I'm sitting there thinking. I mean, you know.
Chucky.
If you've watched The Shawshank Redemption 2 weeks, that should be you don't watch that movie before you go to prison. In fact, there ought to be a book like Prison for Dummies.
Yeah.
Because we have the highest incarceration rate of any developed nation, so there ought to be a set of rules so you know what to expect. But, you know, I'm sorry, I digress.
No problem. That's actually quite humorous, my friend. Keep going.
I go to my cell. My cellmate is a young African-American guy. Now, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. So he looks at me. He doesn't say a word. He just looks at me. So I figure, okay, when someone speaks to me, I'll speak to them. Otherwise, I'm probably best just to shut up. So we didn't say anything. The next day, he comes in. He looks at me. He says, yo, man. He says, what you in here for? I'm not making fun, by the way he talked. It's important to catch the whole feel and experience of this, what took place.
Okay.
And I'm sitting there, and now, Goldie, you've seen me. So I'm sitting there, and I'm trying to muster my most harsh, evil, wicked, I'm a tough guy look. You know, and that was hard.
Yeah, Chuck, that's really not. I know you had the two personalities. I don't see that personality or that aspect of you anywhere close by. Maybe that aspect was in another lifetime. But
it might have been another lifetime, but, you know, I was having a hard time mustering up John Wayne or Clint Eastwood
Exactly. I just don't see the Mr. T in you.
No. So I look back at him, and I said, well, I'm a thief. He looks back at me and says, word? And I'm like, word? He said, yo, man, I said, word. And I look back at him, and I said, word. But then he says, you don't know what I'm talking about, do you? And he just flies out of the room. It was like the freaking Tasmanian devil just goes, whoom, out of the room. Now, here's the funny thing. I know this is radio, so it's kind of hard to capture this. But I'm speaking to a group of executives, you know, in some ballroom someplace that's mostly baby boomer aged white folk. And I go through that little statement that just took place in that prison cell. And they're like, I don't understand either. What does word mean? So, I mean, you
know, the kids today, now if I'm speaking to a group of university students, they totally know.
They created Word.
They created Word.
Exactly.
But, you know, to the white folk, I have to say, okay, now the translation is, really, you don't mean it. I can't believe what you're saying.
Exactly.
Are you telling me the truth? Okay, that's Word.
Right.
So I'm sitting there trying to figure out what the hell just took place, because I'm just, like, baffled.
Right.
And then all of a sudden he comes back in the cell, and he says, yo, man, he says, I'll make you a deal. And I have to tell you, the thought that crossed my mind was, I've been here for 24 hours, and I got a convict wanting to make a deal with me.
Right.
Then it occurred to me I was a convict, so why not?
Let's make a deal.
Said,
show us what's behind curtain number one.
Yeah, right, really. Help me out here a little bit. I don't know what we're doing, whatever.
Okay.
So he says to me, he says, listen, he says, you ain't going to make it in here. He says, you got to learn the lingo. He said, I can teach you the lingo. And he says, you know, I can teach you the rules and so you understand what's taking place. He said, I'll even have your back while you're here.
Oh.
If you'll teach me how to speak correctly so that when I get out, I have a chance at getting a real job.
Wow. I mean, wouldn't you call that the first divine experience from, you know, coming back from here?
Yes.
Yeah. Let me ask you a quick question. Wait, before you go on, are you still in contact with this gentleman today? Or do you,
Let me say this to you.
Okay.
He taught me how to hang in the ghetto, so to speak.
Okay.
You could put me in the worst part of any city, and I could communicate, and I'd probably be okay. In fact, I've got a credential. It's called 11642058.
Right.
Okay. On the other hand, when he got out, because I preceded him in getting out of prison, when he got out, I helped him get his first job.
Excellent. Well, outstanding there, Chuck.
Now, we have lost contact since then because he moved away, and his name is fairly common. And so I have searched, you know, the internet type thing, and there are so many folk with his name, I haven't been able to find him.
Right. And I mean, and he can probably find you if he wants to, and he might sometime. Who knows? You know, maybe he's just fabulously doing well, and the testimony is by him not contacting you is that the testimony is he is doing well.
Well, the thing that I do know is once you have been incarcerated in federal prison, you are in the Bureau of Prison database, and so I can look him up and I can look me up, and if you have ever gone back, it will show that, and he has not, and neither have I.
Outstanding. Yay!
That's very good. Yay, I agree with that.
Yeah, I'm sure you do.
Now, you started this thing tonight, and you said, you know, how did you get into motivational speaking?
Right.
So let me answer that question, and it actually came from prison.
Okay.
I had been in prison for 6 months, I guess-ish.
Right.
5.5, 6.5, somewhere in that range. And 5 inmates were selected out of 500 to be allowed to leave the prison and to go speak to groups outside of prison. And I was one of those 5.
About being in prison?
Yes.
Okay.
Inmate speakers, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Like a scared straight kind of thing?
Yeah, kind of, except we would speak to Rotary, Kiwanis, youth groups, elementary schools or middle schools. So some of it was scared straight to students. Others was presentations to adults.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
The first group we spoke to was a group of fifth graders. And, you know, the fifth graders were told the day before, now you're going to have some guests tomorrow to come and talk to you after lunch, so you need to be on your best behavior. You know, you can hear the English teacher passing that information along.
Okay.
And so the next day we go speak. And, you know, the kids are all in the class, and all of a sudden there's a knock on the door, and then, you know, one of the guards steps in, and he's got his white shirt and his badge on and stuff, and the kids are like, oh, crap. And then 3 inmates come in, and we're in our inmate uniforms.
In orange?
Well, actually, no, it was what I call puke green.
Okay.
Okay. That's
alrighty, then.
Descriptive, I can make it. Orange is, you know, that's for TV.
Okay.
For the most part.
Okay.
Or county jail. Anyway, we go in to speak, and when it came my turn, I asked the kids a question. I said, I'm curious about something. Were you told that we were coming? And they said, yes. You know, these are fifth graders. They're going to be just like blatant honesty.
Absolutely.
And I said, okay, so let me ask you this question. You knew that after lunch, when you left the lunchroom or the cafeteria and came back to class, that there was a chance you might see the speaker in the hallway coming to your class who was going to make this presentation. So I said, what would you have looked for? How would you have known that the person in the hallway was the guest speaker? Here's what the kids said. They said, well, we could have looked outside and seen the car that they drove. One kid said, well, we would have known it was our guest speaker by the kind of shoes they had on. One kid, fifth grader, said, well, we'd have known because of the type of watch they had on their arm. And the kids started rattling off everything that was surface evidence that somebody was, quote, successful.
Yeah, I was going to say, the stuff that put you there, huh?
Yep. Now, it occurred to me as I sat there and I talked with the kids about what it really meant to be successful. It hit me in talking about that these kids in the fifth grade were indoctrinated to believing that a person's value was based on the clothes, the car, the watch, the shoes, the stuff.
Yeah.
And my question today in 2009 is it any different?
For fifth graders or anybody?
Anybody. I mean, you know, you think about, you know, you watch TV and the successful people have more bling. You know.
Okay, See, now you just said it. The successful people have more bling. No, there are people with bling. Are they successful should be the question.
Yeah, and that's the real question. But when you see the outward expression from the media, and I'm not blaming media, if it's advertising, if it's paid media, if it is just media reporting, if it is the president, and I'm not criticizing the people that I'm talking about, but the question comes down to what is coming out of our mouths? What are we really saying?
Okay,
are we really saying that success is defined by the surface?
Okay,
stuff?
Wait a minute. Let me interrupt with the chat room. What's going on in there?
Sure.
One name, two words. Susan Boyle.
Susan Boyle
is not about bling.
You're absolutely right. And you know what's cool about
that? Rock and roll,
that?
Trish, that was a great answer. Keep going.
Yeah. What's really cool about that is it's refreshing. Now tell me, I mean, you know, your chat room folk are going to be in this. Wasn't it refreshing? Wasn't it just exquisite when this woman walks out and everybody sees Susan Boyle and is like, oh, good Lord. And then she belts out this song. Wasn't it refreshing to see that people could embrace success that isn't defined by stuff?
It was downright like is immaculate as the day Jesus was born. I mean, I'm telling you, when I saw her video, I watched it 100 times, Chuck, 100 times. Bawling my eyes out. I can't even tell you how much that woman, on a physical, emotional, and spiritual level, dropped me to my knees that a star had been born. And when I say that, I mean Bethlehem, for me, had literally opened the skies that the next, I mean, because a friend of mine, and people know him in the chat room, Daniel Jacobs, said she literally traveled the planet like a virus.
Yeah.
I mean, like a virus, she went over and around the planet where this whole aspect of the collapse of the economy and the wars, and and just started healing like a virus around the planet with her voice and her exquisite, gentle look of a commoner and somebody who just looked, you know, plain Jane in the most angelic. I mean, I was so like, it was as big a turning point for me, and I mean this with all sincerity, as 9/11 was when that happened for me. I knew it to be that things are going to change because look at it happen. The media can't stop 1 million views of a YouTube video. The media can't drop it in, even though the first thing they wanted to do was give her the makeover.
Right. And see, that's the thing. You know, what you just said, I mean, I really think that is profound in terms of what's taking place. Just at this point, at this moment in time,
yes.
You have a radio show that's taking place.
Okay.
This radio show is, through Blog Talk Radio, is free.
Yeah.
People can, it is viral. People can listen to it if they choose to, but you are not controlled, dominated, or directed by media.
Excellent. I love it.
And that's what happened with Susan, but you're absolutely right. And it goes back exactly to the point with those fifth graders and even where we are today. The mainstream economic machine, I use those terms,
okay.
I think that fits.
The mainstream economic
machine wants you to believe that success is about the car, the clothes, the watch, the external, to the point they want to make over Susan Boyle so she fits the image
Absolutely.
That people would expect so that she supports the mainstream. In fact, if Susan Boyle went through the process of having the facelift, makeover, redo, hair, etc., what would she be saying? She'd be supporting that no matter how good my personal talent is, it isn't good enough unless I look more successful.
Right. And the truth is, with the million hits she had on the YouTube without the makeover, it just was so obvious that it wasn't about what she looked like.
Absolutely.
Ironically, it was about how plain she looked that even the judges went, we judged you, we were
yes.
wrong, and it was the testimony of, you know, well, perhaps this whole media machine is judging and is wrong. It was literally almost like a conscious shift in consciousness heard around the world.
And there'll be more of those shifts.
I agree.
But I also believe, Goldie, that as shifters in consciousness, it won't be that there's going to be one thing and it stops. There will be lots of smaller things that ultimately have an effect.
I agree with that as well. I agree.
You know, when I talk to the fifth graders, and I want to go back to this because I don't want to lose this.
No.
But when I talk to the fifth graders, here's what hit me. What hit me was, I don't know, I'm saying this, it was that thought, and it still exists. I really don't know exactly what the path is. It's not that I can sit here and say, at the ripe old age of 51, soon to be 52, in 2009, that I have a crystal ball and I know what the hell's going on. I don't.
Right.
Okay? I'll just tell you that on the front end. I really don't have a clue. I'm just on the journey and enjoying every minute of it.
It's why we love Chuck.
the thing that I did learn from the fifth graders was, if there is a mission that we come to this life to accomplish, if in fact that is true, then my mission is to be able to help people, young or old, you know, whatever age,
right.
understand the impact of choices and consequences.
Okay.
That you know, I walked out of that group of fifth graders and I said to myself, somewhere in my lifetime, I will be paying it forward. I can never pay the people back. I'm not talking about money, but the people that saw value in me that helped me. Yeah, they can get their money back. That's one thing. But I can never repay them for the trust that they placed in me, for the value that they saw in me. They gave me something that I cannot give back to them. But what I can do is I can pay it forward. And perhaps when I speak to college kids or high schools or middle schools or whatever it happens to be, when I am speaking to people, they can somewhere in this story capture the understanding that, one, every choice has a consequence. You can't escape the consequences. And I've learned that as a value. And so when I got out of prison, I went to work for a company that owned cemeteries and funeral homes, and I sold cemetery property door to door. And people asked me the question and said,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Ding dong, hi. Would you like a cemetery
plot? Like, okay, look.
Wow.
We're all in a human body.
Start you at the bottom, huh? Sorry.
Let's start it. That's true, but that's okay. I was all right with that because here's what happened.
Okay.
I figured two things. Number one, everybody had to have some place to go.
Right.
Because it's against the law for just you to drop a dead body on the side of the road. That's considered hazardous waste, subject to 5 years in prison and a $5,000 fine. And, hell, I just got out of prison, so I figured if nothing else I could help people understand, you can't just dump your old dead husband on the side of the road. You got to do something.
Okay.
All right. And so, therefore,
and you can't have a bonfire with him in the backyard either, right? That's also
no, that's not technically not allowed either. Yeah.
Okay, sorry. My bad.
I mean, you know, okay. We'll
Word? Word?
Work? You can't put them. You can't burn them in the backyard. I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Go ahead.
You can have so much fun with the death stuff. You know, like
yes,
I used to say, we're the last folks to let you down. You know, people were just dying to get in our location. I mean, you know, it's crazy. But you know, whenever you're like me, it always seems funny. Everything seems funny.
Exactly. Exactly.
But here's something that was fairly significant that took place. You know, I get out. I was fortunate that somebody was willing to hire me. I was paid on commission. So as a result of that, if I didn't sell, I didn't eat. Okay. Well, that was a good motivator for me to do something.
Okay.
And the end result of it was that I decided that I was going to accomplish success. And what I meant by that was that if in the human experience that meant I had to sell, then I would be the best there could be. If I was going to be a janitor, I would be the best at it. It didn't make any difference what the task was. It didn't make any difference how much I was being paid. Whatever the task was, we all have choices in this lifetime that we're living as spiritual beings. We have the choice to be mediocre or to be the best.
Okay.
It is a choice.
Okay, now, and let me interrupt because, see, at this particular moment in your history, your definition of success has gone from an outward experience to an inward experience.
It was an inward experience, and the inward experience was I had the power and the control to be able to define whatever it is I wanted to define myself by.
Right.
Now, I was having a spiritual experience, but I was living in a physical world, which meant I had to eat.
Right.
Okay? So, therefore, if I had to eat, it wasn't that success was being best means, ooh, I make more money. Success was, am I choosing within whatever framework I'm in, am I choosing to be the best at it?
Okay. Yep.
Okay?
Yep.
Now, I can be the best janitor in the world and make minimum wage. But the question is, am I doing something, you know, just for the money and sit back and say, well, they're not paying me enough, so I'm just going to give it a lick and a promise and move on. Some of this stuff may be made way too colloquial. But, you know, is that what I'm going to do? Or am I going to be superior in the performance of whatever it is that I am responsible for doing? And people would say, if it was a janitor, wow, this is the best I've ever seen this place.
Okay.
Because payment, appreciation, recognition, many of the things that can feed us can happen outside of money, stuff, things, possessions.
Absolutely.
And I found that when, you know, a lot of people, well, as we talked at the very beginning, you know, you get out of prison and it's like, well, I'm a convicted felon and nobody's, you know, this is a rough way to put it, but, you know, I use this in seminars and so far nobody has gotten too upset with me.
Nobody's shot you yet, but keep going.
I haven't been shot yet, that's right. But, you know, Jewish people that were put in concentration camps in World War II were branded on the arm.
Right.
They were given a number. So when they got out of the concentration camp, and all of a sudden, you know, here they are, they've been in a concentration camp, and they're, you know, tattooed on the arm with a number that says, you know, you were a Polish Jew or from wherever you happen to be, did that mean that you were nobody for the rest of your life? Or do you have the option to say, I am no longer in that circumstance. I have the power to make my life whatever I choose to make it.
Right.
In my case, I honestly believe that everybody that's in earshot of this is empowered to make their life what they want to make their life. They have to get out of their own way sometimes.
Amen.
And realize that power they have.
Yeah.
But the power is there.
Definitely.
It's all a matter of choice.
Right.
Now, I did know a couple of things. Mm-hmm. I knew that if I left prison and I began quote speaking, then there would be a judgment. People would say, well, he can't find anything else to do, so I guess he's gone out speaking and he's making money because he's been a convict, and I don't think that's right, and wah, 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 wah. So I decided that what I needed to do was I needed to find myself. I needed to find, what does it truly mean to be a Chuck Gallagher? What is it that I bring to this world? What is it that I can do that will benefit other people? And I first focused inwardly on understanding every day that I'm alive, I remember that I have been 11-6-42-058, and that every choice has a consequence. And so go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, you've been that number in the prison experience, but that was never all of who you are, ever, ever.
No.
It was an experience. It was a portion of this particular lifetime. But really, the truth is, you were never completely your digits.
No, the digits are nothing more than a tattoo stuck on my arm. And honestly, to you, I don't have a tattoo, but you know what? I don't care if anybody does. The reality is, it's much like that. In that, when you get up, you get reminded. You get reminded of, so you don't forget.
Okay.
Okay. Well, are you still there?
Yeah, no, I'm still here because I see some people, if they don't forget, sometimes they linger in the victim.
That's right.
You got to transcend the experience, because there's always something garnished in every opportunity and every challenge. There is the resolution and the transcendence of that experience in every single opportunity.
That's absolutely correct.
And you know, let's emphasize that.
Well, it's a very true statement. Sometimes, it's my way of putting it, but you know, if I didn't have the tattoo, so to speak, then I might be tempted to forget what I experienced and fall back into what perhaps the media and society would want me to fall back into, which is life is a function of and success is a function of the outward symbolism that we have attached to success, as opposed to the inward beauty that a Susan Boyle brought to people's remembrance and recollection.
Well, as well as the inward beauty that you started recognizing that you wanted to be the best at what you were, whether it was a janitor, whether it was a salesperson. That is also the beauty of Chuck becoming one with his essence, the bigger self. That's a beautiful time in any one person's experience.
Yeah, it's funny, Goldie, because when I do a presentation, I'll often have people ask me questions. By the way, if folks in the chat room want to do that, you know, you can relay them to me. I'm sure you will.
Okay,
but,
yeah. Wait, let me say the number real quick. Or Trish, put the number up to the phone, because just do that. And yes, and you can ask Chuck a question on the chat room, and Trish will get it through to us. Okay, keep going. Thanks, Joe.
The thing that I just completely lost my train of thought.
Okay,
what in the heck was I going to say?
Listen, we're going to rewind. This is about your moment that when you recognized in self your essence, which was doing the best job you were going to do, as the importance of, as the value of how you would judge your own success, the importance of being the best at what you do. Not the money, not the outer, but how you felt inside. You were validating your own beingness.
That's
huge.
True. And Goldie, when I do a presentation, people will ask this question. They say, it's kind of funny. They'll say, well, if you had it to do over again, would you do it? And, you know, there's kind of two answers to that question. There's the obvious. No. What idiot do you know would just voluntarily say, you know what, I can't wait in this life to really screw up so that I can go to prison?
Right.
I mean, you know, that's just kind of dumb. But, after people get the, okay, no, we wouldn't do it again answer, the real answer is, however, prison was the best experience of my life.
Exactly.
Because prison helped me get past and understand what did it mean to be a Chuck Gallagher. Now, let me tell you a story. Christmas Day, 1995, that was the first and only Christmas Day I was ever in federal prison, ever in prison.
Okay.
Christmas Day, 1995.
Federal or otherwise.
Yeah, federal otherwise. Christmas Day, 1995, there were 500 men in this prison where I was housed. And I would venture to say, as big and burly as some of these guys were and, you know, rough and tough, most of them ended up spending time somewhere privately shedding a tear.
Okay.
And I was no different.
Okay.
But I had a weird experience. I was laying in the bunk in my cell. And I was on the top bunk, and tears were streaming down the side of my face, and I had a weird remembrance. And the remembrance was back sometime, and I couldn't tell you exactly when, but we'll say it was in the 80s. I remember going to the grocery store. It's a weird story, but I'll share it with you because it really was profound for me.
Okay.
But I remember going to the grocery store. I was going to get steak and shrimp, put them on the grill, you know, that kind of thing. Got the little plastic, you know, container, went to the back in the meat department, got the steak and shrimp, went to the checkout counter, you know, the one that was supposed to be the speedy line. And, of course, somebody in front of me had like 21 items in a 12 checkout line, and it was like, you know, I'm just kind of agitated. And
right.
Anyway, so they get, they check out. I get up to the line. I've got my steak and shrimp. I'm ready to move on with this thing. And the checkout lady looks at me and she says, oh, you're Chuck Gallagher, aren't you? Now, I looked at this lady, Goldie, and I was like, I didn't have a clue who was talking to me. I mean, I'd never seen the person before, at least I didn't think so. But they had on a little name tag, and it said Susie. So being a nice person, polite, I said, well, hi, Susie, how are you? She said, you don't remember me, do you? Well, I didn't want to admit that, but that was true.
Right.
And she said, we went to high school together. She said, and I read about you all the time in the paper. She said, you have got a great career. She said, I am so proud of you. She said, it's great to talk to you. And I was sitting there thinking to myself, I don't have a clue who this woman is.
Okay.
I mean, I just honestly didn't remember. But, you know, not being a rude person, I thought to myself, okay, well, you know, I'll be nice. And she's like, I read about you in the paper all the time. And she said, let me ask you a question. She said, do you have any kids? And I said, well, yeah, actually, I do. I have one. And then I made a fateful mistake. I asked her if she had any. Now, you know, as a guy, if you ask a woman if she's got kids, you need to be prepared to listen to the story. You know? So
okay.
She says, oh, yes. And then she stops checking me out, reaches down below the counter at the grocery store, grabs her purse, puts it on the counter, opens her wallet, and drops open, you know, 15 pictures of her three kids.
Okay.
And starts telling me about them. Now, by this point in time, people behind me are frustrated.
You know, they're clearing their throat, and they're like, you know, would you move it on? You're in the express lane of the grocery store. You know, I really didn't care about her kids, but I was trying to be nice, and she was just going on, and it was like, oh, good Lord. Well, anyway, she finally finishes, and she says, you know, I can't wait to see you again. You know, you'll have to come through my line when you come back through. I'm thinking, I don't think so, but whatever. I check out. Now, I walk out all cocky into the parking lot, going up to my new BMW, swinging my steak and shrimp, and here's the thought that went through my head. I'm thinking, you know, here I am. We went to high school together. I'm a successful CPA. I'm getting ready to get in my new BMW, drive to my house, put steak and shrimp on the grill, and this Susie lady is... We went to high school together, and she's just a checkout chick at the grocery store.
The judgments begin.
So Christmas Day, 1995, that all plays back. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, as tears stream down both sides of my face, Susie was more of somebody than I ever dreamed of being. She was, and I'm using the term loosely, the Susan Boyle of her family.
Right.
She was home on Christmas Day. For any of the people that are on the call, if you've had children or brothers and sisters or remember whenever you were a little kid, man, on Christmas morning you get up and you'd run to see what Santa Claus left. And, I mean, you know, most of the time for most families in America, that's a joyous time.
Right.
And there she was. She was with her three children. She could hold them in her arms. She could say to them, I love you. I, on the other hand, was in a top bunk. The best I could do that day was stand in a line behind other prisoners waiting my turn to make a three-minute collect telephone call to my two sons.
Right.
To say to them, Rob, Alex, it's Christmas. Daddy loves you. Merry Christmas. So I got it that day that success really has nothing to do with the stuff. In fact, Goldie, I would say before I took the 23 steps, I thought that I made good choices. After I became 11-642-058, I understood clearly that every choice has a consequence. Every choice has a consequence. Before I took the 23 steps, I really lived life as an illusion. I was like the David Copperfield of my life, and everything was not as it appeared. After I became 11-642-058, I understood that when you can peel back the illusion, when there is no illusion, then you're actually free to live true life.
Right, because the prison was in the belief that the success came in the stuff. The prison started before you went to jail.
The prison started for me before I went to jail. And one of the questions that I'll often ask audiences is, what prison are you in?
Exactly.
Because prison doesn't mean, ooh, you went to jail or you were handcuffed or you were put behind bars. We can be imprisoned by a faulty set of beliefs in living an illusory life.
Absolutely.
You know, people ask me often, they say, okay, Chuck, well, let me get this because, you know, you've been a senior VP and you've been this and that and the other and all these titles and stuff. And it's like, how do you do that and be a convicted felon? Well, the first thing is I don't live an illusion.
Right.
And I don't care who I am, where I am. Let me rephrase that. You know, I don't care where I am. I will be easy. I'm easy and open to admit that I have been convicted of a felony and served time in federal prison. I don't want people to not know me for reality. Whatever tags, whatever labels, whatever you want to put on me, you know what? I'll put them on myself.
Right.
So that it's just open. I had prostate cancer 4 years ago. I'm open about that.
Right.
I talk openly about it. I have written blogs about the experience of treatment and the experiences
of the side effects of prostate cancer. I am open about that, and I get calls from men every week who are talking about, thank you for having put that on the internet so that they have something to read other than from a medical practitioner. Yes. I have nothing to hide.
That's awesome.
So when you remove the illusion, then you're actually free to be successful. You're free to live a life that is joyful, and you can create whatever you define as success.
Absolutely.
And I the last thing I'd say related to that is before I took the 23 steps, I really defined success by the external surroundings. And after I became 11-6-42-058, and especially speaking to the fifth graders, I understood success in a different method. I understand, for me, success isn't the stuff. Success is the impact that you have on other people's lives.
Say that again.
Now, success is the impact that you have on other people's lives.
Hmm.
It's funny when I say, you know, I got out of prison and I sold cemetery property.
Which, by the way, somebody wants to know how long you did that.
Well, I was involved in that process until August of 2009.
Oh,
I mean, excuse me, August of 2008. We haven't got to
August
of 2009.
Wow, okay then. And now he's a time traveler.
Time
that will be the next.
Hey,
we'll talk about
cool.
that next.
Yeah, our next time is time traveling. But, you know, the funny part about it is in that industry, here's a reality check. As many funerals as I have been to, the reality is there is no one that ever talks about the stuff. You're remembered for the impact you have on other people's lives. That's where success transcends material possessions.
Right.
And if in the world that I revolve in, if I can help people understand the correlation between choices and consequences, between eliminating the illusion and truly impacting the lives of other people and claiming their personal success, you know what? I will have paid it forward, and I will consider this lifetime to be successful.
Indeed. Indeed. I'll tell you, when you were just speaking on, you know, like the last segment we were talking on, I really felt you. I mean, I really felt that you know, experience you had with the checkout girl and knowing that she was there holding on to her children, and you know, I just felt that. And unfortunately, it does seem that as a planet, we're going through this this great collapse, so that we can all kind of remove the glasses of the, you know, rose-colored glasses of what we have been worshiping for the last 500 years or 2,000 years. I mean, pick a time frame where we lost the essence of what God, quote, is and what love is and what life is, which, by the way, in my belief systems, God, love, and life are all synonymous.
Right.
And we went to that, you know, when people say, you know, I pray for money. I try to talk them through and say, okay, well, what is having money? What will that bring to you? And they're like,
right,
well, I can pay my bills. And it's like, okay, now go to the feeling. And what's the feeling you have when you can pay your bills? Well, I feel relaxed. So I tell them, then why don't you pray for to be relaxed and peaceful? Because maybe
right,
it's not going to come to you in the dollar. Maybe you're going to meet a person you sew, and they own an apartment building, and you can get barter your month's rent or 3 months' rent because you can sew all the curtains for the apartment buildings that he needs. And so everyone is serviced and everyone is satisfied, but no money ever exchanged hands. It's you wanted to feel good and have your rent paid, and the landlord or whatever wanted his apartments to look pretty so he could feel, you know, that he could give the best sell.
Right.
You know, it's like people don't even, I speak the word, what's the essence that you're praying for and that you're intending, and they don't even know how to connect with. They're like, essence? What's essence? And I'm like, okay, let's start at the beginning. Because when we connect with the essence, we connect with the part of us that starts understanding we are the creators of the prison cells. We can be the creators or uncreators of those prisons, and then recreate the joy of everything that we believe we want, but it would look totally different when you have it from the essence as opposed to having it from the symbol of what it is.
Right.
It will look totally different. You're
yes.
making you're getting me deep here, Chuck.
You know, getting deep is not necessarily a bad thing.
I love it.
It's challenging for folks sometimes to be willing to get there or to go there. It's much easier, in a sense. It's not as productive, by the way, but it's much easier to allow yourself to labor in the illusion of lack and that it's someone else's fault and that you're a victim and there's nothing you can do about it.
Well, okay,
to take responsibility for what you are perfectly able to create for yourself.
Right, and the only reason why it's easier is because the media and the machine perpetuates that. That's the only reason why it appears to be easier. But the truth is, from an energetic point of view, it takes tremendously more energy to try to work through symbols than it does to create from essence. Tremendously more energy to create and hold on to the illusion than to genuinely be the truth, which is love, God, and life. Tremendously
right.
easier. You know, again, it's the flips upside down.
It's hard. It is easier, but it also requires a consciousness that many people, they're not there. They haven't had the
dark night of the soul.
The dark night of the soul and the profound experience of understanding how all of that interplays. That's when I said, you know, prison was the best thing that ever happened to me. It's not that I want to go back. I always try to make that clear to the universe because I don't want them giving me something because it seemed like I'm enjoying it. I didn't. But it was a profound education and an awareness. It was an eye-opening awareness for me that honestly, you could have told me, someone could have told me, I could have listened to radio shows for years
right.
and not learned what I learned by going through that experience, by making the choices that I made.
Right. Well, I mean, the whole point of the dark night of the soul is to bring us out of the shallow end of the human and into the vastness of the soul.
That's the point of it.
The
shallow end of the human is where it becomes so easy to get caught in that we don't even recognize the vastness of the soul.
Right, because the prison started long before you had the numbers. That's the amazing part. When you look at the people who are in the shallow of the human, they're already in prison and they could be living in these gorgeous homes where people are going, that's not prison, that's success. And yet I will know, like, from the nanny perspective, you know, being like in the house and kind of what I would call like behind the curtain.
Right.
And you can see that there's no joy. They're stressed out. They're on tremendous medication because their body is collapsing. The relationship with their children and their wives or husbands are collapsing. It's just all this. It's the Wizard of Oz. It's the Wizard of Oz. It's just this picture to look pretty imperfect, and behind it and below it, there's nothing that's holding that
right.
up. That's real. Nothing.
Right.
I see that. I live in Fairfield County, the richest county in America. And as a nanny, I have seen that more often than I have seen the joy of people experiencing their children and the beauty of their essence and their children's essence. I don't see that a lot where there's usually a lot of money. I just don't see it.
Right.
Sad, because imagine having both.
Right. Well, it's I will say to you, Goldie, it's been an interesting journey thus far. Mm. It is a joy every day. Now, I don't mean to walk around saying I'm you know, walking Mr. Bliss. I mean, there are days when it's like, okay, you bump your leg against the, you know, cabinet, and it's like, crap, that hurts. And I remember the other day I had worked on Saturday. I was whooped. I mean, I was whooped. We just moved. My wife and I had just moved. And I, you know, I'd been moving boxes and stuff. And I was wanting a tea from Bojangles, of all places, little place, you know, down in the Southeast. And they make the best sweet tea. Y'all folk up in the Northeast love you, but y'all don't understand how to drink iced tea. You've got to put sweet in it. It's got to be like glucose good stuff. But anyway, I'm sitting there, and I was behind some lady that had to have 10 children in a van, and they were taking forever. And I had one of those human experiences where I was just unhappy. And even in the state of unhappiness at that moment, the reality was it was just a choice that I was making. I could just choose to be happy because I was experiencing and living life.
Right. And you can always, you know, sit in your silence and know you are free. I mean, right. Freedom has got to bring joy to someone, even if they're free because they're homeless living in a tent. You're free.
Yep.
I mean, that's how I would feel. I mean, freedom for me is extremely important. And what I wanted to comment, too, is, you know, the dark night of the soul is not something that happens to people once. And it's not that you would go back into the same prison, but every layer into the vastness of the soul will become an opportunity and a challenge to face a fear, to face an addiction, to face power. That happens
right.
on multiple levels, because the ultimate place we're going to get is that we're God also.
Right.
And there are layers that are going to be peeled back and peeled back and peeled back, and it's usually, from what my teachers and my own experiences will tell you, the three challenges we have are fears, addictions, and power. Those are the milestones we go through in levels of consciousness. And
mm-hmm.
For the human experience, you will recycle and go deeper and recycle and go deeper and recycle and go deeper until you come out where you no longer are magnetized to the planet, because you're pure. You're perfect humility. Your perfect light, and then the journey goes on from there.
Well, I wish I could say I was there, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to go through a few more cycles.
Well, you and me both, but you know what? We know that we made it through the first one, two, three, whatever it is. I mean, I've been through a few nights, dark nights of the soul, and I'm cool. I'm strong. I'm confident. And when the next one comes, I have that much more experience of what this is like, that I know this too shall pass.
Right.
What I expect when I'm done with it is that I'm lighter, brighter, and more expanded, and that it's, you know, it's part of the journey.
Yes.
I'm so glad.
It's part of the journey, and it's part of the experience, you know, that we've had here tonight is just part of the opportunity to share how something can take place. But also, it's like the book that I wrote called Second Chances, Transforming Adversity into Opportunity. Every adversity that, or what we might perceive as adversity, is in fact just an opportunity to grow and to expand. And it's really our choice as to what we want to do with those things.
Absolutely. Listen, we are coming up to the top of the hour. Are you going to be someplace? Is anything going on you want to plug? Needless to say, Chuck, we're going to have you on again. I love you, and you motivate me and inspire me. I hope everybody felt the same that was live in the chat room and that gets that in archives. But is there anything you want to tell people where to find you, or products, or you know, books, anything?
Well, I'll tell you, the only thing, Goldie, that I will mention here is I do have a new book coming out. It's my first book, honestly.
Okay.
It's called Second Chances, Transforming Adversity into Opportunity. And it really goes into the depth of what took place. And at the end of the book, and I debated on the title, but there are I took 23 steps to get into federal prison. So I really deciphered what would a person do if somebody came to me and said, you know, Chuck, I've really got this problem in X area, whatever that may be. What can I do to transform adversity into opportunity? And I came up with 23 steps, and those are featured in the back of the book. But if you go to my website, chuckgallagher.com, on that website, on the home page, there's a picture of the book, and if you'll click that, because it is right now in preprint form, if you click the picture, then you can buy it at 50% off of the retail price, which is basically the price that I have to sell it to Barnes & Noble for.
Cool.
So the way I look at it is, if somebody wants to pre-subscribe to the book, go to my website, click on the picture, you get it for half the retail price, or $10. And what happens with the book is the net profits from the book go to the Choices Foundation, which is a foundation that I created, which supports presentations being made to middle to high school kids so that they perhaps in their formative years can at least grasp the concept of choices and consequences. And maybe, just maybe, there's one of those kids that'll be touched by the story that can think about when they're faced with one of those life-changing choices, perhaps they can think about the consequence that follows and make a choice that truly empowers their future.
Outstanding. That's an awesome, awesome foundation. And clearly you're passionate. I mean, it's kind of, you know, what do they say about standing on the shoulders from the one before you?
And there have been great ones before me, and I am thrilled that they saw something in me that I didn't see in myself, and maybe somehow I can help other people see in them the divinity of who they are, not the illusion of the humanness that they are masquerading as.
Exactly. What a gift to give them. You're actually giving them their selves back to them, their real selves, the big selves, the vast self, or at least the opportunity to see it within themselves.
Right.
That's huge. That's huge. And I believe that right now on the planet, it is happening. Just as Susan Boyle went across the planet in a viral-like experience of love and beauty, the things that you're offering are going across the planet in the same notion, because I do believe there is a great awakening happening in every culture, in every country, in everything. It's not just the people. The animals are shifting. The plants are shifting. The minerals are shifting. The sky is, you know, everything is kind of raising itself up and saying, you know, let's go back and connect to the essence of who we are. And that's extraordinary. That's just extraordinary. Do I sound a little preachy today?
You know, that's, you go, girl. You go on with your bad
stuff. Hallelujah. We are all ascending, but I really do believe it. Oh, Chuck, we're kind of coming up to the top of the hour. Anything closing? I mean, we kind of closed just now.
Well, I tell you what. I am amazed by the value that you bring to the audience. I am so appreciative of the time that you've allowed me to come on and talk tonight. Welcome the opportunity to come back. And Golden, love you. Peace to you.
I love you, Chuck. You'll definitely come back. He's a regular. Come back because he's got so much to share on so many other topics. Tonight was really about, I wanted you guys to get to know Chuck, why I love him. And now you guys can love him too. So I love you guys in the chat room. Yes, I'm not going to come home with tan lines, guys. That's just not going to happen. I'll be inside doing my L-mean pod. I will come back. All right, I got 90 seconds. I will come back with stories, though. I promise, promise, promise. I love everybody. Have an amazing night. I will see you On the flip side, remember, next week we air on Thursday nights, 8 to 10. Thursday nights are our regular night. I'll just be on a plane tomorrow. I love you guys. You guys rock. Thank you for coming into the chat room and sharing your energy with all of us. Rock and roll, everybody. See you next week. Bye. Still there? I am, but I shut it down. It should have shut down. Okay. Hello?
Can you hear me?
I can. I don't know how we're doing this. I just
I'm going to hang up and call you back.
Okay.
All right, love you.
I love you too, baby.
Bye.
Bye.